Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
TTU-HSC selects Benton as regional dean. The Texas Tech University Health Science Center has announced Dr. Timothy J. Benton as regional dean for the Permian Basin campus, effective September 15th. Benton, who served as the interim regional dean since May, also was named the Jan and Ted Roden Endowed Chair, a move that took effect September 1st. The Jan and Ted Roden Endowed Chair was established in 1999 to enhance and support the regional dean at the School of Medicine, Permian Basin Campus. I'm excited to have Dr. Benton serving in this new leadership role, TTU-HSC President Lori Rice Spearman said in a news release. He understands the healthcare needs of the Permian Basin, and his innovative approaches have significantly enhanced access to comprehensive care, not only for those living in this region, but can also serve as models nationwide. TTU-HSC has much to offer our faculty and students, and Dr. Benton will fill a pivotal role as we strive to transform healthcare through innovation and collaboration. Benton received his medical degree in 1994 from the TTU-HSC School of Medicine and completed his residency in family medicine at the University of Texas Health Center at Tyler. In 2005, he joined the TTU-HSC School of Medicine facility in Amarillo, where he served as the Associate Residency Program Director before eventually becoming Program Director. He completed a Faculty Development Fellowship from the Keck School of Medicine with the University of Southern California in 2006. In 2012, Benton was recruited to the Permian Basin campus to serve as regional chair for the Department of Family and Community Medicine. He immediately focused his attention upon the residency program and expanding patient access to primary care. His efforts helped the department grow from 6 faculty members to nearly 20 and increased annual patient visits from approximately 18,000 to 22,000 per year. I persuaded Dr. Benton to move to the Permian Basin from Amarillo in 2012 to take the regional chair position, School of Medicine Dean Dr. Stephen Burke said in a news release. Dr. Benton's leadership abilities are excellent, complementing his outstanding skills as a physician and teacher and his West Texas values. With Benton's guidance, the Permian Basin's Family Medicine Residency Program also expanded, growing from 6 positions a year to 16 for a total of 48 physicians residents, an accomplishment that was highlighted in the April 2021 edition of Texas Medicine Magazine. He also helped to develop a rural residency training program with Andrews, Fort Stockton, Pecos, and Sweetwater, Texas. And Carlsbad and Hobbs, New Mexico will join the program in the near future. In addition, he developed numerous community health care collaborations with UT Permian Basin and Odessa College, the Ector County Health Department, the Permian Basin Community Center Clinic, and others. He also currently serves as the Ector County Associate Health Authority. Benton has worked to create an active working relationship with Midland Memorial Hospital and Medical Center Hospital and helped to orchestrate a hospital list fellowship program. He also aided the department in successfully applying for a $3 million 1115 waiver grant that reimburses hospitals for uncompensated care they provide to uninsured patients and funds innovative health care projects, often related to mental health services that are not available to low-income Texans. He understands the healthcare needs of the Permian Basin, and his innovative approaches have significantly enhanced access to comprehensive care not only for those living in this region, but can also serve as models nationwide. TTU-HSC has much to offer our faculty and students, and Dr. Benton will serve a pivotal role as we strive to transform healthcare through innovation and collaboration.
Hello, this is Michael, reading more articles from the Odessa American, published Tuesday, September 21st, 2021. Police identify man involved in fatal collision. In a press release issued Monday afternoon, the Odessa Police Department identified the 49-year-old Odessa man involved in a fatal collision over the weekend. The driver was identified as Charles Mello. OPD and Odessa Fire Rescue were dispatched at 12:32 a.m. September 19th to the 4500 block of South Highway 385, the press release stated. The investigation reportedly showed a black 2000 Chevrolet Silverado was traveling south in the northbound lanes of the 4500 block of South Highway 385. The Silverado collided with a white 2015 Ford F-250 that was northbound in the inside lane, being operated by Emmanuel Garza of Odessa. He and his passenger, Annabelle Pignon of Odessa, were both transported to Medical Center Hospital, where they were treated and released. The collision caused the F-250 to collide with a red 2006 Toyota Camry that was northbound in the outside lane, being operated by Maria Arriga of Odessa, the press release detailed. She and her two passengers, Araceli Arriga and Daniel Arriaga, were treated on the scene and released. The driver of the Silverado, Mello, was reportedly pronounced dead at the scene. COVID has killed about as many Americans as the 1918-19 flu, the Associated Press. COVID-19 has now killed about as many Americans as the 1918-19 Spanish flu pandemic did, approximately 675,000. The U.S. population a century ago was just one-third of what it is today, meaning the flu cut a much bigger, more lethal swath through the country. But the COVID-19 crisis is by any measure a colossal tragedy in its own right, especially given the incredible advances in scientific knowledge since then and the failure to take maximum advantage of the vaccines available this time. Big pockets of American society, and worse, their leaders, have thrown this away, medical historian Dr. Howard Merkel of the University of Michigan said of the opportunity to vaccinate everyone eligible by now. Like the Spanish flu, the coronavirus may never entirely disappear from our midst. Instead, scientists hope it becomes a mild seasonal bug as human immunity strengthens through vaccination and repeated infection. That could take time. We hope it will be like getting a cold, but there's no guarantee, said Emory University biologist Rustam Anita, who suggests an optimistic scenario in which this could happen over a few years. For now, the pandemic still has the United States and other parts of the world firmly in its jaws. While the Delta-fueled surge in new infections may have peaked, the U.S. deaths still are running at over 1,900 a day on average, the highest level since early March, and the country's overall toll stood at just over 674,000 as of midday Monday, according to data collected by Johns Hopkins University, though the real number is believed to be higher. Winter may bring a new surge, with the University of Washington's influential model projecting an additional 100,000 or so Americans will die of COVID-19 by January 1st, which would bring the overall U.S. toll to 776,000. The 1918-19 influenza pandemic killed 50 million victims globally at a time when the world had one quarter the population it does now. Global deaths from COVID-19 now stand at more than 4.6 million. The Spanish flu's U.S. death toll is a rough guess, given the incomplete records of the era and the poor scientific understanding of what caused the illness. The 675,000 figure comes from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The ebbing of COVID-19 could happen if the virus progressively weakens as it mutates and more humans' immune systems learn to attack it. Vaccination and surviving infection are the main ways the immune system improves. Breastfed infants also gain some immunity from their mothers. Under that optimistic scenario, school children would get mild illness that trains their immune systems. As they grow up, the children would carry the immune response memory so that when they are old and vulnerable, the coronavirus would be no more dangerous than cold viruses. The same goes for today's vaccinated teens. Their immune systems would get stronger through shots and mild infections. We will all get infected, Anita predicted. What's important is whether the infections are severe. Something similar happened with the H1N1 flu virus, the culprit in the 1918-19 pandemic. It encountered too many people who were immune, and it also eventually weakened through mutation. H1N1 still circulates today, but immunity acquired through infection and vaccination has triumphed. Getting an annual flu shot now protects against H1N1 and several other strains of flu. To be sure, flu kills between 12,000 and 61,000 Americans each year, but on average, it is a seasonal problem and a manageable one. Before COVID-19, the 1918-19 flu was universally considered the worst pandemic disease in human history. Whether the current scourge ultimately proves deadlier is unclear. In many ways, the 1918-19 flu, which was wrongly named Spanish flu because it first received widespread news coverage in Spain, was worse. Spread by the mobility of World War I, it killed young, healthy adults in vast numbers. No vaccine existed to slow it, and there were no antibiotics to treat secondary bacterial infections. And, of course, the world was much smaller. Yet jet travel and mass migrations threatened to increase the toll of the current pandemic. Much of the world is unvaccinated, and the coronavirus has been full of surprises. Markle said he is continually astounded by the magnitude of the disruption the pandemic has brought to the planet. I was gobsmacked by the size of the quarantines the Chinese government undertook initially, Markle said, and I've been gobsmacked to the nth degree. The lagging pace of U.S. vaccinations is the latest source of his astonishment. Just under 64% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of the vaccine, with state rates ranging from a high of approximately 77% in Vermont and Massachusetts to lows around 46% and 49% in Idaho, Wyoming, West Virginia, and Mississippi. Globally, about 43% of the population has received at least one dose, according to Our World and data, with some African countries just beginning to give their first shots. We know that all pandemics come to an end, said Dr. Jeremy Brown, Director of Emergency Care Research at the National Institutes of Health, who wrote a book on influenza. They can do terrible things while they're raging. COVID-19 could have been far less lethal in the U.S. if more people had gotten vaccinated faster, and we still have an opportunity to turn it around, Brown said. We often lose sight of how lucky we are to take these things for granted. The current vaccines work extremely well in preventing severe disease and death from the variants of the virus that have emerged so far.
September is Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. The story was written by Carol A. Cates, Chief Nursing Officer at Odessa Regional Medical Center. I went to Montana a few weeks ago for a memorial for one of my uncles. One of the things I do whenever I go to see my family in Montana is to go visit the family plot in the Churchill Cemetery. As I walk the cemetery, there are a few graves I always stop at and pay my respects. One is my grandparents, and the others are all my aunts and uncles. There are 5 little headstones near my grandparents for several of those aunts and uncles. Those 5 headstones are for aunts and uncles I never was able to meet because they all died as small children. I think about those 5 headstones every time I teach or write about diseases or conditions that take our babies before they have a chance to grow up, or worse, take care of a patient and family who are struggling to fight a childhood chronic disease. Childhood cancer is one of those diseases. Medical care in the 1920s to the 1940s, when my parents lost their babies, was very different than it is today. For instance, one of my aunts died of croup at age 18 months. Today, we don't think of croup even as something serious. The reason we don't think of it as serious is because we now have antibiotics. Antibiotics didn't exist when my aunt died from croup. They were introduced to the public about 5 years later. Childhood cancers are like that. Not so long ago, a childhood cancer was almost always a death sentence. Less than 20% of kids survived cancer in the early 1960s. But that has changed radically. Now about 80% of kids in the U.S. survive cancer. But even at 80%, we have a long way to go in fighting childhood cancers. It is my hope that soon we will look at childhood cancers as we now look at croup, something minor that a few days of treatment will fix. Even for kids that survive, cancer treatment is often painful and difficult. We can make this better for every child who gets cancer. To get there, though, we need to rally behind the science of cancer treatment for kids. That starts with awareness. That is why September is designated as Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. Part of that awareness is supporting funding for childhood cancer research programs. One well-known example of a children's hospital that participates heavily in childhood cancer research is St. Jude's Children's Hospital. That hospital needs about $2.2 million to operate every day. That is not just for research, but for care, but that is still a substantial price tag. The costs also show in the worldwide statistics. According to the American Childhood Cancer Organization, the 5-year survival rate for kids with cancer in high-income countries is 80%. But the 5-year survival rate for kids with cancer in low-income countries is less than 8%. In other words, kids in high-income countries are more than 10 times more likely to survive cancer than kids in low-income countries. Health disparities between the wealthy nations and the poor nations mean that 44% of children who die of cancer, the diagnosis is made after death. There are just not the resources like hospitals, doctors, and testing to diagnose cancer in kids, much less than treat it in many parts of the world. Just like with the technology in your home, treatments advance, costs come down, awareness benefits everyone. Even in high-income countries, childhood cancer still exacts an awful toll. Childhood cancer is the leading cause of death by disease in children in the U.S., and one in every 285 kids will be diagnosed with cancer before their 20th birthday. Awareness is important because childhood cancers tend to be more aggressive than adult cancers. And like adult cancers, the earlier they are diagnosed, the more likely treatment will be successful. The most common types of childhood cancers are bone cancers, brain and brainstem cancers, leukemia, liver cancer, lymphomas, nerve cancers, eye cancers, rhabdoid tumors or muscle tumors, soft tissue cancers, spinal cord tumors, and Wilms tumors, a special kind of kidney cancer. The ACCO website has great information on symptoms and diagnosis of childhood cancers, www.acco.org. If you are concerned your child may be experiencing these symptoms, please speak to your primary health care provider. This September, remember the kids who suffer from childhood cancer and keep them in your thoughts and prayers. Please support childhood cancer research with your words and, if you can, with your pocketbook. Every person in this fight makes a big difference.
Flooding feedback needed from residents, organizations across West Texas. If you live in West Texas and have experienced flooding at your home or business, the Upper Rio Grande Regional Flood Planning Group wants to hear from you. As part of the Texas Water Development Board's statewide flood planning process, the Rio Grande Council of Governments has sponsored the URGRFP PG, to ensure West Texans from across the 23-county area have a voice in helping the state prioritize flood control projects. The ongoing Upper Rio Grande Region 14 Flood Plan is identifying and evaluating projects to mitigate flooding for people, property, and businesses across the region. Quote, the URGRFPG brings together technical experts from across the state and across the region to help leaders strategically plan investments in flood control infrastructure, end quote. URGRFPG Chairman Omar L. Martinez of the El Paso County Water Improvement District No. 1 said in a news release, quote, since the planning area is larger than the state of Indiana, public input from across the region is critically important to ensure local issues from El Paso to Sonora and from Presidio to Kermit are addressed, end quote. Participating in the planning process helps ensure the flood mitigation projects, strategies, and priorities are represented in the Upper Rio Grande Regional Flood Plan and ultimately the 2023 State Flood Plan. Going forward, only the projects listed in the 2023 State Flood Plan will be eligible for funding support through TWDB's Flood Infrastructure Fund. Here's how you can get involved. Attend regional flood planning group meetings and subcommittee meetings in person or online. Complete this online survey at tinyurl.com/K7N9D8UD to provide feedback for your community or for flooding impacts to your home or business. The survey is also available in Spanish. Review the online data collector and submit observations for flood-prone areas in your community and other information at tinyurl.com/F4DJP2ZF. Attend one of three open house public meetings, which will be held in El Paso, Presidio, and Pecos later this year and in early 2022. When those meetings are scheduled, they'll be posted here, tinyurl.com/F4DJP2ZF.
Ideal living will with detailed instructions. Dear Dr. Roach, at what point in COVID-19 does a person's do not resuscitate order become an issue? When does treatment become an exceptional or extraordinary effort? It would seem that organ transplants, if not coma prolonged artificial ventilation, would qualify. I have never seen anything on this issue. Answer: do not resuscitate order is not one size fits all. Ideally, a person considers carefully what they want and, with the help of an expert, writes up a document called a living will to go over how that relates to a variety of circumstances. Since it's impossible to consider every possible situation, it is also wise to discuss your feelings with a designated person who becomes a patient's health care proxy through a document called a durable power of attorney for health care. This person can then help the team of doctors and others taking care of the patient in situations not specifically addressed by the living will. A living will may also specify that a person would want everything medically appropriate done, except in the case that they have been diagnosed with a serious or terminal illness. In the case of COVID-19, many people who have contracted the infection have pre-existing health conditions that have made them vulnerable and have a living will indicating that they don't want exceptional or extraordinary care. There are many other terms used, such as heroic, but again, it is best to identify with specific interventions a person would or would not want. For some people, this can even include tube feeding, antibiotics, and intravenous fluids.
This is the Dear Abby column. Prison sentence complicates long-time friendship. Dear Abby, I have a former high school classmate who over the years I've gotten pretty close to. He has been there for me when I was at my lowest, and I have been there for him as well. He lives several hours away, but we talked almost daily in addition to being on social media. A few months ago, I stopped hearing from him, and his social media profile went dark. I had a bad feeling, so I Googled him and was shocked to see he had been arrested. While it wasn't a violent crime, it was horrible just the same. He has called me several times from prison declaring his innocence, always requesting money. Abby, I live paycheck to paycheck. Even if I had extra money, I wouldn't feel comfortable giving it to him. I feel hurt and used. Part of me says I need to end the friendship. The other part says he needs friends right now, and it's not my place to judge him. I have refused to accept his last few calls because I really don't know what to do. Your thoughts are appreciated. Signed, Blindsided in Pennsylvania. Dear Blindsided, this person hasn't used you yet. The next time he reaches out, accept the call. When you do, make it clear that you can offer moral support, but you cannot give him money because you live paycheck to paycheck. You may not hear from him after that. But if he continues to ask, take a giant step backward and recognize this friendship has run its course. Dear Abby, my husband and I have been together for 3 years. He recently went back to his home state, 1,000 miles away, for what I thought would be a 2-day trip to grab some things from his late mother's estate. He has been unemployed for most of this past year due to the pandemic, so I'm somewhat conflicted about something he told me when I called to ask when he was coming home. He said he found a job and decided he wants to stay there and work for some months to save up enough money to pay off the bulk of our debt. He did not consult me before making this decision. He told me he has worked out a COVID-safe housing arrangement with his sister and his aunt. The type of work he will be doing, there is something he could do here where our home is. I don't want to discourage him, but it baffles me that he would take a job 1,000 miles away. What if something were to happen to me or our animals? When I told him I didn't agree with his decision, he told me I should be happy he's no longer unemployed. How should I handle this? Signed, Far Away in Missouri. Dear Far Away, your husband shouldn't have taken a job 1,000 miles away without first talking to you. That said, what's done is done, and you need to let this play out. There's nothing to stop you from visiting. Fortunately, you and the animals are all doing well. If circumstances change, he can always quit the job and come back. When the time comes, welcome your debt-free husband home. There will be plenty of time for the two of you to hash out in person what caused him to make such a disruptive decision if there were similar jobs available in your own community.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.